from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, no news inserts in this broadcast. It's like having a Chevy dealer host the first 3 minutes of car talk. I don't know. But we're back to normal. We snap back to normal, and it's all, ladies and gentlemen, about, as you who happen to be in show business know, it's all about timing. It's all about timing. You know, content is good, but it's about the timing. So, of course, the sheriff would wait to arrest Scott Peterson until after the war is over, because he's not going to get any tube time if that collar happens while we're still pacifying Mosul, which, by the way, we're still doing. But it's timing. You see, there was a great deal of criticism of the United States for rushing. We'll hear some more of the criticism of the United States for rushing pell-mell, or Lucky Strike for that matter, into the war. And a lot of observers said, well, it's because the weather gets so bad, don't you know, in Iraq, and the soldiers in the hazmat suits and the whole thing. Which could be, but ladies and gentlemen, look at it from this side of the equation now. It was crucial to start the war when it began, so that it could end in time for sweeps. Now, I reminded you about a month ago to remember this. I'm reminding you now to remember it again. March 7th, 2003, in a town meeting with MTV, Tony Blair. We don't need Iraq's oil. We export oil. There is a simple way of dealing with this issue, because whatever happens, there's always a conspiracy theory. It's some terrible conspiracy machination. We want to seize the Iraqi oil. A simple way out of this, says Tony Blair, we should make sure in any post-conflict Iraq there is a proper UN mandate for Iraq, and that oil goes into a trust fund, and we don't touch it, the Americans don't touch it, without UN authority. Now, we can't say fairer than that. It's not for nothing to do with oil, says Tony Blair. The best way of testing that is to let the thing be done under a proper UN mandate, so no one touches the Iraqi oil except where it's needed for the Iraqi people, because it's their oil, not ours. March 7th, this year, Tony Blair. Just put it away, file it in the where you file forgettable proclamations. And, you know, war is a teaching device, ladies and gentlemen. It was thus advocated by none other than Richard Perle, who said the basic value of the war in Iraq would be that after it, the United States could point its finger, oh, let's say it's Syria or other miscreants, as we might see them, and send a two-word message, quote Richard Perle, the two-word message, you're next. So did the message get through? Said North Korea's foreign ministry this week, quote, the Iraqi war shows that to allow disarmament through inspections does not help avert a war, but rather sparks it. Only a tremendous military deterrent force can prevent attacks on states disliked by the U.S., says North Korea, which is, I believe, building nuclear weapons, probably for another reason. You know, ladies and gentlemen, the conservatives like to say when it comes, you know, because war is a teaching tool, but so are textbooks, teachers. But conservatives like to say when that subject comes up, you can't throw money at a problem. However, we have found that you can, in their eyes, throw money at a problem. A lot of it, as long as the money explodes. Hello, welcome to the show.
There ain't no city with every beat of the drum. I make me want to get out with it, have a whole lot of fun. We gotta go dance, dancing, I'll have to see you. Come on, baby, Lord, yeah, just you and me. A big time serenade, we're going to a street parade. And we gonna second line, we're gonna have a good time, time, time. Hit me, hit me, hit me, yeah!
Not in New Orleans yet, from the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, saying goodbye to Earl King. This is another edition of Le Show. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to the edge, to the aforesaid edge. And let's just, so many apologies a week. Why wait? Let's avoid the rush.
We're so sorry.
The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, starting with, how about the Archbishop of Canterbury? Is that an apology for you, ladies and gentlemen? Is that, you think that's... apology enough? The Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, has been forced to apologize to Britain's 330,000 Freemasons after he said their beliefs were incompatible with Christianity and that he'd rejected them, Freemasons, from senior posts in his diocese. He's written to Robert Morrow, the Grand Secretary of the United Grand Lodge of England, in an attempt to defuse the row. He apologizes for the distress he caused and discloses that his own father was a Mason. His comments about Freemasons were in a private letter leaked to the media shortly after he was appointed as head of the Church of England. Subsequent attempts by his advisors to defuse the row only caused further offense. A spokesman said the Archbishop was worried about the ritual element of Freemasonry, which has been seen as satanically inspired. Yeah, you got to watch out for that ritual stuff. In his letter of apology, Dr. Williams tries to distance himself from his own reported comments. He claims his views were never meant to be public and were distorted by the media. Well, he added, the quoted statements about the satanic character of the Masonic ceremonies did not come from me and do not represent my judgment. He does not, in his letter, deny he has misgivings about the role of Freemasons within the church. You can't quote those feelings. They were made privately. How about Secretary of State Powell? Am I getting some apologies for you, or what? When a student asked Secretary of State Colin Powell about the 1973 military coup in Chile, he made no secret of his deep misgivings about the U.S. role in that upheaval. It is not a part of American history that we're proud of. The matter might have ended there had not Washington operative William D. Rogers, he served under Secretary of State Kissinger as the department's top official in Latin America. He noticed Powell's televised comment. In a highly unusual move, the State Department issued a statement that put distance between the department and its top official. The statement that asserted the U.S. government did not instigate the coup that ended Allende's government in 1973. But Powell, it's kind of an apology. But but we'll not file it officially in that category quite yet. American Airlines has apologized, responding to an outcry from employees, labor leaders, and Washington lawmakers. American Airlines has canceled the bonuses it promised to pay senior executives who stayed at the carrier through January 2005. Retention bonuses, because they've done such a good job running the airline. We need these guys, because otherwise, you know, some other company that wants to lose $2 billion a year is going to snap them up. In a letter to Americans workers, Donald J. Carty, American's chairman and chief executive, apologized for the concern the bonuses have caused our employees. American didn't make details of the bonuses public until after it had negotiated deep wage concessions with its union workers. And they were ticked. The baseball, I predicted this a week ago. Here it is. The Baseball Hall of Fame president issued an apology Friday, saying he was sorry he failed to call Tim Robbins and Susan Sarandon last week before canceling a Bull Durham celebration because of the actor's anti-war stance. In an open letter to the 28,000 people who called or sent a letter to email to the Hall of Fame, Dale Petrosky blamed himself for bringing politics into the shrine. Yeah, he invited Ari Fleischer last year. That he wasn't a problem. I inadvertently did exactly what I was trying to avoid, the former Reagan administration official wrote. With the advantage of hindsight, it is clear I should have handled the matter differently. I'm sorry I didn't pick up the phone to have a discussion with Tim Robbins and Susan Sarandon, rather than sending him a letter. He'd made no mention of whether he still believed the decision to scrap the event was the right one. So he's sorry he didn't pick up the phone. Basically a commercial for Sprint. Sony Corporation said its U.S. video game unit would withdraw an application to use shock and awe as a trademark, describing the move to capitalize on the catchword of the war in Iraq as an exercise of regrettable bad judgment. The Japanese electronics giant apologized in a statement posted on its internet site this week. Sony concurs with the views of those who have expressed strong criticisms regarding this conduct by the subsidiary. It was an exercise of regrettable bad judgment in that it disregarded the context in which the term has been used. The phrase shock and awe was coined, but apparently not trademarked, by military strategist Harlan Ullman in a 1996 publication. He used it to describe a tactic of pressuring the enemy to give up with little fighting. More about that moments from now. News from the rear coming up, but still more apologies. Iraq's much-ridiculed former information minister was portrayed Thursday in a bizarre ad for horse racing as an announcer who likened the winner's triumph to a jihad. Northlands Park in Edmonton, Alberta, which placed the ad and operates a sports center that includes a racetrack and the Edmonton Oilers' home ice, says it regrets the advertisement and any offense it caused, especially for referring to an athletic win as a jihad or holy war. I'm apologizing for offending anybody with the ad, if it does offend people, and I'm anticipating it will, says Eric Young, the president of Northlands Park. Attention, Californians. Oil giant BP has apologized for the questionable and embarrassing practices by one of its former U.S. traders accused of trying to boost profits by creating artificial market prices. Responding to a 13-month investigation by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission into California's energy crisis, BP said it regrets and apologizes for the behavior of its trader. The commission cited telephone transcripts showing how BP and Reliant Energy traders attempted to drive up prices through circular transactions on an electronic trading platform operated by Bloomberg. Hello, Mayor. The trader, who has not been named for legal reasons, allegedly bought power from Reliant, a Reliant trader, Reliant being another energy company, and immediately sold it back at the same price on three occasions, influencing market values, a practice known as a wash trade. Gee, it's common enough there's a name for it. The commission has no rules against wash trading. The practice is viewed as damaging to the integrity of a market. And it would violate the commission's rules if used to manipulate prices. If it's just done to waste time, I guess it's okay. BP and Reliant and Enron are battling to convince the commission that they did not manipulate electricity prices during California's energy crisis. Or manipulate the crisis during California's energy prices. Anyway, BP apologizes. Enron's bankrupt and Reliant, it's the weekend. A Regina, Saskatchewan gynecologist has issued an apology to his patients after about 300 medical files from his office recently turned up in a recycling bin. In a written statement issued this week, Dr. James Bastian said he intended to shred the inactive files, but they were instead inadvertently disposed in a recycling bin. "I apologize to my patients who have given me their trust and responsibility for their charts over the years," he said. "I deeply regret any breach of confidentiality that may have resulted." The files include patients' names, hospitalization numbers, and detailed medical information. Hey, if you feel violated by that, turn off your TiVo. Red-faced Tokyo Medical Examiner's Office officials publicly apologized this week after cremating a man they mistakenly believed to be somebody else. A simple clerical error led to the first mistake in the exchange of remains since the 1948 inception of the office. Hey, General MacArthur must have set it up. "It was something that should not have happened, and we are terribly sorry," said Seiji Fujita, a spokesman for the office. Florida, Dateline Tallahassee, State Representative Dick Kravitz apologized to Muslims this week for a comment he made last week when he explained his appreciation for Muslim culture and added that he regretted not dating one of their women. In a letter to the Council on American Islamic Relations, Kravitz said he wanted to apologize to anyone offended by the remark and said he was cut off at the committee meeting before being able to explain it. Kravitz is a Jacksonville Republican. He was discussing a bill that would have barred state financial aid to students from six countries on the State Department's terrorist list. The bill was defeated. During the panel's meeting, Kravitz's bill was decried by one speaker as racist because most countries on the list are Islamic. Kravitz said he was offended by that comment because he spent time in the 1960s living with a host family in Indonesia. "I spent 2 years with a Muslim family. I ate their food and lived with them," he said. "The only thing I regret is I didn't get to date one of their women." The remark drew audible groans and some nervous laughter. Kravitz said this week, as soon as he said it, the committee chairwoman cut him off. He didn't have a chance to explain the meaning of his comment. He said he had expressed interest to his host family about a particular woman when he was in Indonesia, asking if it would be okay to meet her and drink tea or have cookies. But the woman was already promised to another man as part of a prearranged marriage, and Kravitz was told it would be very dangerous. "That's the story that was never told," Kravitz said. He also noted when he was sworn in on the Jacksonville City Council, he asked a Muslim imam to say a prayer at the induction ceremony because of his appreciation for Islam. The apology has been accepted by a local Islamic official. And Representative Louise Slaughter is offering an apology to go along with her fundraising appeal. She's throwing a fundraiser to celebrate her new appointment to the Select Committee on Homeland Security. Most lawmakers have suspended fundraising or at least trying to be low-key during the war. She said the fundraising letter was sent before the war started and realizes that it might seem appropriate during the war. Now she can send it now. "Our emphasis was on first responders and Homeland Security," she said. "I apologize if it appears unseemly." The fundraiser occurred as scheduled in her Capitol Hill home. Ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week. You know, that's a good run of apologies, I think. I'm not patting anybody on the anything, but those are some apologies. You got a sorry ass world out there today. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's get down to it. Weapons of mass destruction. I know everybody's talking about it, and we're wondering, as a matter of fact, the British Labour Party members who were against the war in the first place are now challenging Tony Blair. Let's find those weapons. All right, I'll tell you where we can find weapons of mass destruction. You want to find some weapons of mass destruction? The Washington Post tells you where to look. Bacterial strains remain in private hands in South Africa, where they have continued to attract attention from individuals interested in acquiring them. One such individual approached the United States. The United States balked at his asking price for turning the materials over. The episode throws new light on the extraordinarily difficult task of preventing the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. South Africa built nuclear, chem, and biological arsenals under apartheid, renounced its weapons in 1993, sought to destroy all traces of them, including instruction manuals and bacterial seed stocks. But like other countries that have attempted such a rollback, Ukraine and Kazakhstan, South Africa finds it in a gray zone. The weapons programs were ostensibly terminated, yet clearly they weren't able to destroy everything, says one non-proliferation expert. These things never really went away. So you can just head on down to Joburg, get yourself some dreams, some fine dreams. Who's setting the fires? Who's doing the looting? Who's setting the fires? There's a lot of finger-pointing now by critics of the war and critics of the administration. The people who said we didn't have enough troops to win the war, which apparently we did, are now saying, well, we don't have enough troops. We didn't have enough troops to run things after the war. And the troops seem to agree. They keep saying, well, we don't have enough guys here to do this. The sacking of Mosul apparently took place while there were only 200 U.S. Special Forces operatives on duty in Mosul. That's a city of 2 million. That's a bad percentage. That's a bad average. From the London Observer, at a single firefighting unit that's still active in Baghdad, in one day the men have fought fires in a bank, bus company, printing press, flour factory, and a tea company. All arson. The major in charge thinks the culprits might be, here's an interesting point, ignored widely. Remember about 6 months ago, Saddam Hussein, with a great flourish, announced he was opening the prison doors and letting everybody out. He didn't let everybody out, of course. But he did let a lot of people out of prison. Well, the major at this fire station thinks the prisoners let out might be the arsonists. Or Kuwaitis seeking their revenge for the 1990 invasion. Apropos of the looting of the museum, the antiquities. The Hague Convention deals with this, not Alexander Haig. Haig, the place in Denmark, in Holland. The Hague Convention dealing with the protection of cultural property in the event of armed conflict was passed in 1954. The United States and Britain never signed because they want to be free to use nuclear weapons. A second protocol updating the details as to how the convention should be carried out was produced in 1999. The U.S., Britain, and Australia have not signed that. A lot of people are saying, well, you know, we protected the oil, but we didn't protect the museums. We didn't protect the oil either. From the New York Times, the rumor that Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath party planned to destroy the northern oil wells with explosives as they did in Kuwait in 1991 appears to have been a wartime myth. Managers at North Oil concur with the initial American assessment that the infrastructure survived the war intact and that it was nearly ready to change hands with little more than the installation of new management and the passing of the keys. Then, this is in, I believe, Mosul. It's North Iraq. Then came the looters. By nightfall on April 11th, North Oil's buildings were stripped, some were sacked, and set afire. Even the toilets were taken. Windows were smashed, doors shattered. The looters were Kurdish soldiers and civilians. They stacked oil company cars with ceiling fans, light bulbs, spare tires, soiled mattresses. What were they doing at the oil company? Cracked porcelain and flower pots. They tore down drop ceilings to take the aluminum and sell it for scrap. They took the computers that ran the company power plant and phone network, the trucks, forklifts, and buses that tended to the oil fields, and the shelves, chairs, desks, and file cabinets in the offices. Some Kurds drove away in cranes.
Yeah, we've spotted Kurds in cranes.
The stolen goods were rushed past a Kurdish military checkpoint where Kurdish soldiers waved the thieves through. As the looting frenzy ended, hopes of a smooth transition for northern Iraq's oil industry were ruined. So we didn't guard the oil either. What were we guarding? I love Donald Rumsfeld on the looting.
Oh, goodness. We see that same footage of a guy taking away a vase. How many vases did they have there?
We know. We were told. We were told because authorities in this country, in Russia, and other countries gave the Pentagon a complete list of the antiquities to be protected before the war started. Citing the wanton and preventable destruction of Iraq's Museum of Antiquities, the chairman of President Bush's Advisory Committee on Cultural Property, that's an important job, has submitted his resignation. He's going to be missed. Another of the committee's nine members is also resigning over the issue. Someone please tell President Bush he has such a committee. While our military forces have displayed extraordinary precision and restraint in deploying arms, they've been nothing short of impotent in failing to attend to the protection of Iraq's cultural heritage, Martin Sullivan wrote in his resignation letter. The tragedy was foreseeable and preventable, he wrote. The tragedy was not prevented due to our nation's inaction. Gary Vicken, director of the Walters Art Museum in Balmer, also resigned, who calls his action similarly symbolic. He said, I had to do something. Who's doing the looting? Don't know, but they know where to look. They knew what to take. According to the Brits, they didn't take the replicas that were on display, and some of them had keys to the vaults and glass cutters to go into the display cases. These guys are good. I want them on my team. The Fog Watch, ladies and gentlemen. From CNN, on Monday, the 2nd Brigade of the 101st Airborne Division. You see, it's really, it sounds so good when you have the number of the unit right there. You nailed it down. The 2nd Brigade of the 101st Airborne Division has found about 11 vans. About 11. Buried underground near Karbala, Iraq, according to a senior officer, Brigadier General Benjamin, it's spelled freakly and pronounced frakely, described the vehicles as dual-use, biological and chemical mobile labs. The troops also found about 1,000 pounds of documentation. The mobile labs were found buried close to an artillery ammunition plant, Frakely said. Later in the week. Not mobile weapons labs. I don't have that story here. The fog has disturbed me. Maybe they were then. Okay. Well, that's. But bickering and confusion have hampered the search for biological and chemical weapons in Iraq, according to civilian experts. The experts criticized military efforts to use troops to uncover, like General Frakely, to uncover caches of weapons, or caches, as one Marine said this week, of chemicals and nerve agents, while preventing weapons inspectors with substantially more experience from entering Iraq because of bureaucratic infighting. Oh, here we go. This week, a military officer thought he had found several mobile labs buried under mounds of dirt. They turned out to be containers of biological equipment that could be used for either military or scientific purposes, but no one found evidence they'd been used to make weapons. Okay, so General Frakely is off the hook. Oh, back to the looting for one moment, and then we'll get back to WMD. Somebody should use those call letters now. That's great advertising. The United States Army ignored warnings from its own civilian advisors that could have stopped the looting of priceless artifacts in Baghdad. Iraq's National Museum was identified as a prime target for looters and should be the second top priority for securing by coalition troops after the National Bank, said a memo sent last month by the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, set up to supervise the reconstruction of post-war Iraq. Looting of the museum could mean, quote, irreparable loss of cultural treasures of enormous importance to all humanity, the document concluded. General Jay Garner, the head of OARHA, that's the office that's rebuilding Iraq, is said to be livid. We asked for just a few soldiers at each building, or if they feared snipers, then just one or two tanks, said one ORHA official. The tanks were doing nothing once they got inside the city, yet the generals refused to deploy them. And look what happened. More than 2 weeks after the March memo was sent, ORHA was told it had not even been read. The official admitted, however, ORHA had not identified hospitals, which were also ransacked, as a potential target, as they had not imagined that the Iraqis would resort to killing their own people. You know, I think we need imagination training in this country. We didn't imagine people would... Yeah, we did. We did imagine. Okay. So, civilians are saying, civilian experts are saying, let's send civilian experts in to look for weapons of mass destruction. Military experts are saying, let's let the military do the job. Those in other countries who are poised to criticize the United States are, of course, poised to claim that any weapons of mass destruction we eventually do find may have arrived there at the hands of Americans. So there are those who are saying, well, let the UN weapons inspectors back in. That way they'll give legitimacy, believability, credibility to this whole task. So proving that he's not a politician, not exactly smoothing his way back in. Hans Blix says, war against Iraq was a foregone conclusion months before the first shot was fired. In a scathing attack on Britain and the U.S., Blix accused them of planning the war well in advance and of fabricating evidence against Iraq to justify their campaign. He told the Spanish daily El País, the country, there is evidence this war was planned well in advance. Sometimes this raises doubts about their attitude to weapons inspections. He said he was misled by President Bush. At a meeting last October, Bush backed the work of UNMOVIC, the UN inspection team. But at the time, Mr. Blix knew there were people within the Bush administration who were skeptical and were working on engineering regime change. So he's making friends in Washington. And, ladies and gentlemen, I floated it on the newsletter this week. By the way, if you want to subscribe to the newsletter, don't send it to the regular address. Send it to this address for faster results. Liblast, L-E-B-L-A-S-T, dash, subscribe at LuxMedia, LUXMedia.com. Just because, you know, conspiracy theories are, if you don't actually bond to them, they're nice, just kind of brain teasers. So I floated one. So far, nobody's really shot it down. I'll shoot it down. The complaint was, well, Saddam, we know he had these weapons of mass destruction in the 80s, and he's never provided the documentation for destroying them. So what if he destroyed them because he was afraid that maybe there would be real consequences, not knowing? But crafty weasel that he was, or is, decided not to provide documentation so as to throw a little frisson of ambiguity into his neighbors. You know, maybe he's got them, maybe he doesn't. It's a bad neighborhood. No, I can't shoot that down. What am I saying? I'll work on it. I'll get back to you.
Boyfriends. don't count for much if Sony goes off roof. Is she really going out?
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is At Loggerheads, a contemporary issue seen through a neatly bifurcated prism. Today, is Saddam Hussein dead or alive? On the left, Joan Rivers. On the right, Yakov Smirnov.
Joan, United States has most fearsome, precise, and relentless military machine assembled since the second Star Wars movie. If we had real-time intelligence, Saddam Hussein was meeting at that restaurant in Baghdad. Man is toast. In Russia, toast make you. That tape of him walking around Baghdad, that's phonier than 3 kopeck note. In Russia, currency spend you. What a country. Sure, there's smoke in background of that video. It could be oil fires, or it could be 2 guys named Mohammed with a hookah. In Russia, hookah smoke you. Anybody who sees Saddam Hussein walking around city of Baghdad, they're going, let's see, loyalty to cruel tyrant or big reward from America. Not to mention free trip to Hollywood for Leno show. In Russia, old cars drive Jay Leno. Face it, Joan, Saddam Hussein is more finished than floor in his winter palace. Whoever's still sending out tapes, probably working from old script. Believe me, I know the feeling. In Russia, toilet go down career. Joan?
Yakov, please. Saddam Hussein may be a lot of things, but two, he's not. Attractive? Ugh, could you work out just a little? And B, stupid. Why are we sure it's the real guy in the restaurant and the body double in the street? Yeah, maybe it's the other way around. I mean, body double's got to eat too. This man is a survivor. He's got more lives than Alan Thicke. He's got tunnels so big, the light at the end is just from the next tunnel. You think David Copperfield knows something about escape? Saddam is probably in exile right now, shaving his mustache, working on his tan, getting his son's porn collection out of storage. This story is so not over. It makes Star Trek look like an anecdote, please. Like in Afghanistan, we won a great war, but we missed our guy. In addition to the Army and the Marines, maybe next time we should send in a few Crips. Yakov, this is not the time for arrogance. It's the time for middle-aged Arabs to stop wearing berets. From the left, I'm Joan Rivers.
And from the right, I'm Yakov Smirnov. We're both in shock and awe whenever we're
at Loggerheads.
At Loggerheads is made possible by a grant from the Dichotomy Foundation, helping Americans take sides. I'm Ira Zitkin. Join us again next time for another dose of topical antithesis at Loggerheads. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, Canada, you're next. Richard Pearl didn't say that, but that seems to be the message. We're going to get tough on the Canadians. Just one day after canceling a presidential visit to Ottawa, the White House announced this week that Australian Prime Minister John Howard will visit George Bush on his Texas ranch. See, FaceTime is a gift. The Canadian Prime Minister's office offered 3 dates next fall for an Ottawa visit in place of the date that the president canceled. The White House rejected them all. Colin Powell says Mr. Bush may still visit Canada in the fall, although diplomatic sources say the president is unlikely to go to Ottawa while Jean Chrétien remains prime minister. Powell reaffirmed the Bush administration was disappointed in the initial Canadian response to the conflict in Iraq, but made it clear that strained relations between the two countries would be helped if Ottawa pitched in now that the war was won. Hey, that Canadian money's worth something. I think about 60 cents. We'll take it. News from the rear, just mopping up operations. I don't know if you noticed this odd juxtaposition. But a couple of interesting datelines. One was, of course, in Baghdad, the Palestine Hotel. The newsmen had been moved from the Al-Rashid, where they camped out during the first Gulf War, over to the Palestine Hotel on the other side of the river. And they were operating from there for quite a long time until early in the United States occupation or liberation of Baghdad. The U.S. lobbed some missiles at the Palestine Hotel. Two Arab journalists, one from Al Jazeera, were killed, of course, spiking a wave of criticism in the Arab world that they were being targeted. The U.S. said there were snipers in the area. Those in the hotel said there was no sniper. You know, the usual argument. But that happened. And then there was Jessica Lynch, private PFC Jessica Lynch, who was rescued. Or was she? The Times of London, a conservative newspaper owned by Rupert Murdoch, says the rescue of Private Lynch was not the heroic Hollywood story told by the U.S. military, but a staged operation that terrified patients and victimized the doctors who had struggled to save her life, according to Iraqi witnesses. Doctors at Al-Nasiriyah General Hospital said the airborne assault had met no resistance and was carried out a day after all the Iraqi forces had fled the city. Four doctors and two patients, one of whom was paralyzed and on an intravenous drip, were bound and handcuffed as American soldiers rampaged through the wards, searching for the departed members of the Saddam regime. An ambulance driver who tried to carry Private Lynch to the American forces close to the city was shot at by U.S. troops the day before their mission. Far from winning hearts and minds, the U.S. operation has angered and hurt doctors who risked their lives treating both Private Lynch and Iraqi victims of the war. What the Americans say is like the story of Sinbad the Sailor. It's a myth, says Harith al-Hassouna, who saved Private Lynch's life after she was brought to the hospital by Iraqi military intelligence. They said that there was no medical care in Iraq and that there was a very strong defense of this hospital, he said. But there was no one here apart from doctors and patients, and there was nobody to fire at them, says the Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch. Nonetheless, Private Lynch is on her way back home. Another dateline prominent in this story, Palestine, West Virginia. What an odd coincidence to ask a question rarely heard on this broadcast. What can it mean?
The newsmen all hung out at the Palestine Hotel, just across the bridge from the Al-Rashid, with cameras in the windows and a wet in the room. That's where they stand and do their feed. Then the bombs began arriving at the Palestine Hotel, and some Arab anchors bought it on the roof. You don't want to have a bullseye painted on your door. Same, the vodka's 90 proof. A place to shine, Palestine. The dining's fine at the Palestine. In the firing line, the Palestine. The yellow ribbons dangled in Palestine, West Virginia, and her photograph was nailed to every pole. Then Jessie Lynch was rescued, and her folks went on TV. Auditions Monday for the title role. They say government gave up. they're smarter than they sound. Her folks won't sell her story for a crappy TV movie. There's a better price when the book deal comes around. Great folks you'll find in Palestine. They're the loving kind, Palestine. They don't drink no wine in Palestine. Some kind of sign, Palestine. A greener line.
So this is the new normal. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR. Sure, they'll be on these same stations. There's not a war on. Over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via shortwave on WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 shortwave. Across North America on Sirius satellite radio, and around the world and elsewhere on your computer whenever you want it at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. And it would be just like buying some of those antiquities. Those look nice if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All right, thank you very much. Might get me Uday's Lion, too. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net to subscribe to the Le Show newsletter, such as it is, leblast-subscribe at luxmedia.com. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. All in the timing. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, the satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.